is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. From the North American Review, April 5th, 1907, chapters from my autobiography. From Susie's biography of me. Papa says that if the cholera comes here, he will take sour mash to the mountains. This remark about the cat is followed by various entries covering a month in which Jean, General Grant, the sculptor Gerhardt, Mrs. Candace Wheeler, Miss Dora Wheeler, Mr. Frank Stockton, Mr. Mary Mapes Dodge, and the widow of General Custer appear and drift in procession across the page, then vanish forever from the biography. Then Susie drops this remark in the wake of the vanished procession. Sour mash is a constant source of anxiety, care, and pleasure to Papa. I did in truth think a great deal of that old tortoiseshell harlot, but I haven't a doubt that in order to impress Susie, I was pretending agonies of solicitude, which I didn't honestly feel. Sour mash never gave me any real anxiety. She was always able to take care of herself, and she was ostentatiously vain of the fact. Vain of it to a degree which often made me ashamed of her, much as I esteemed her. Many persons would like to have the society of cats during the summer vacation in the country, but they deny themselves this pleasure because they think they must either take the cats along when they return to the city, where they would be a trouble and an encumbrance, or leave them in the country, houseless and homeless. These people have no ingenuity, no invention, no wisdom. Or it would occur to them to do as I do, rent cats by the month for the summer, and return them to their good homes at the end of it. Early last May, I rented a kitten of a farmer's wife by the month. Then I got a discount by taking three. They have been good company for about 5 months now, and are still kittens. At least, they have not grown much, and to all intents and purposes are still kittens, and as full of romping energy and enthusiasm as they were in the beginning. This is remarkable. I'm an expert in cats, but I have not seen a kitten keep its kittenhood nearly so long before. These are beautiful creatures, these triplets. Two of them wear the blackest and shiniest and thickest of sealskin vestments all over their bodies, except the lower half of their faces and the terminations of their paws. The black masks reach down below the eyes. Therefore, when the eyes are closed, they are not visible. The rest of the face and the gloves and stockings are snow white. These markings are just the same on both cats, so exactly the same. not need two names, so they have but one between them. We call both of them sackcloth, and we call the gray one ashes. I believe I have never seen such intelligent cats as these before. They are full of the nicest discriminations. When I read German aloud, they weep. You can see the tears run down. It shows what pathos there is in the German tongue. I had not noticed before that all German is pathetic, no matter what subject is or how it is treated. It was these humble observers that brought the knowledge to me. I have tried all kinds of German on these cats: romance, poetry, philosophy, theology, market reports, and the result has always been the same. The cats sob and let the tears run down, which shows that all German is pathetic. French is not a familiar tongue to me, and the pronunciation is difficult and comes out of me encumbered with a Missouri accent. But the cats like it, and when I make impassioned speeches in that language, they sit in a row and put up their paws, palm to palm, and frantically give thanks. Hardly any cats are affected by music, but these are. When I sing, they go reverently away, showing how deeply they feel it. Sour Mash never cared for these things. She had many noble qualities, but at bottom she was not refined and cared little or nothing for theology and the arts. It is a pity to say it, but these cats are not above the grade of human beings, for I know by certain signs that they are not sincere in their exhibitions of emotion, but exhibit them merely to show off and attract attention. Conduct which is distinctly human, yet with a difference. They do not know enough to conceal their desire to show off. The grown human being does. What is ambition? It is only the desire to be conspicuous. The desire for fame is only the desire to be continuously conspicuous and attract attention and be talked about. These cats are like human beings in another way. When Ashes began to work his fictitious emotions and show off, the other members of the firm followed suit in order to be in the fashion. That is the way with human beings. They are afraid to be outside. Whatever the fashion happens to be, they conform to it, whether it be a pleasant fashion or the reverse. They, lacking the courage to ignore it and go their own way. All human beings would like to dress in loose and comfortable and highly colored and showy garments, and they had their desire until a century ago, when a king or some other influential ass introduced somber hues and discomfort and ugly designs into masculine clothing. The meek public surrendered to the outrage, and by consequence we are in that odious captivity today, and are likely to remain in it for a long time to come. Fortunately, the women were not in scattered here and there and everywhere over the garden, like so many charred stumps, and they damage the effect, but cannot annihilate it. In summer, we poor creatures have a respite, and may clothe ourselves in white garments, loose, soft, and in some degree shapely, but in the winter, the somber winter, the depressing winter, the cheerless winter, when white clothes and bright colors are especially needed to brighten our spirits and lift them up, we all conform to the prevailing insanity and go about in dreary black, each man doing it because the others do it, and not because he wants to. They are really no sincerer than sackcloth and ashes. At bottom, the sackcloths do not care to exhibit their emotions when I am performing before them. They only do it because ashes started it. I would like to dress in a loose and flowing costume made all of silks and velvets, resplendent with all the stunning dyes of the rainbow, and so would every sane man I have ever known. But none of us dares to venture it. There is such a thing as carrying conspicuousness to the point of discomfort, and if I should appear on Fifth Avenue on a Sunday morning at church time clothed as I would like to be clothed, the churches would be vacant, and I should have all the congregations tagging after me to look and secretly envy and publicly scoff. It is the way human beings are made. They are always keeping their real feelings shut up inside and publicly exploiting their fictitious ones. Next, after fine colors, I like plain white. One of my sorrows when the summer ends is that I must put off my cheery and comfortable white clothes and enter for the winter into depressing captivity of the shapeless and degrading black ones. It is mid-October now, and the weather is growing cold up here in the New Hampshire hills, but it will not succeed in freezing me out of these white garments, for here the neighbors are few, and it is only of crowds that I am afraid. I made a brave experiment the other night to see how it would feel to shock a crowd with these unseasonable clothes, and also to see how long it might take the crowd to reconcile itself to them and stop looking astonished and outraged. On a stormy evening, I made a talk before a full house in the village, closed like a ghost, and looking as conspicuously, all solitary and alone on that platform, as any ghost could have looked. And I found, to my gratification, that it took the house less than 10 minutes to forget about the ghost and give its attention to the tidings I had brought. I am nearly 71, and I recognize that my age has given me a that mention that I have acquired new and great privileges by grace of my age is not an uncalculated remark. When I passed the 70th milestone 10 months ago, I instantly realized that I had entered a new country and a new atmosphere. To all the public, I was become recognizably old, undeniably old, and from that moment, everybody assumed a new attitude toward me, the reverent attitude granted by custom to age, and straightway the stream of generous new privileges began to flow in upon me and refresh my life. Since then, I have lived an ideal existence, and I now believe what Choate said last March, and which at the time I didn't credit, that the best of life begins at 70, for then your work is done, you know that you have done your best, let the quality of the work be what it may, that you have earned your holiday, a holiday of peace and contentment, and that thenceforth, to the setting of your sun, nothing will break it, nothing interrupt it. Dictated January 22nd, 1907. In an earlier chapter, I inserted some verses beginning, "Love came at dawn," which had been found among Susie's papers after her death. I was not able to say that they were hers, but I judged that they might be for the reason that she had not enclosed them in quotation marks according to her habit when storing up treasures gathered from other people. Stedman was not able to determine the authorship for me, as the verses were new to him, but the authorship has now been traced. The verses were written by William Wilfred Campbell, a Canadian poet, and they form a part of the contents of his book called Beyond the Hills of Dream. The authorship of the beautiful lines which my wife and I inscribed upon Susie's gravestone was untraceable for a time. We had found them in a book in India and had lost the book and with it the author's name. But in time an application to the editor of Notes and Queries furnished me the author's name. Note, Robert Richardson, deceased of Australia. And it has been added to the verses upon the gravestone. Last night at a dinner party where I was present, Mr. Peter Dunduly handed to the host several dollars in satisfaction of a lost bet. I seemed to see an opportunity to better my condition, and I invited Dooley, apparently disinterestedly, to come to my house Friday and play billiards. He accepted, and I judge that there is going to be a deficit in the Dooley treasury as a result. In great qualities of the heart and brain, Dooley is gifted beyond all propriety. He is brilliant. He is an expert with his pen, and he easily My game was Karam's. Karam solely. Karam's plane or Karam's with cushion could help anything that could furnish a count. In the course of time, I found to my astonishment that I was never able to run 15 under any circumstances. By huddling the balls advantageously in the beginning, I could now and then coax 14 out of them, but I couldn't reach 15 by either luck or skill. Sometimes the balls would get scattered into difficult positions and defeat me in that way. Sometimes, if I managed to keep them together, I would freeze, and all was when I froze. You had to play away from the contact. There was sure to be nothing to play at but a wide and uninhabited vacancy. One day, Mr. Dalton called on my brother-in-law on a matter of business, and I was asked if I could entertain him a while until my brother-in-law should finish an engagement with another gentleman. I said I could and took him up to the billiard table. I had played with him many times at the club and knew that he could play billiards tolerably well, only tolerably well, but not any better than I could. He and I were just a match. He didn't know our table. He didn't know those balls. He didn't know those warped and headless cues. He didn't know the southeastward slant of the table and how to allow for it. I judged it would be safe and profitable to offer him a bet on my scheme. I emptied the avalanche of 13 brisk and hearty and cheery and self-satisfied young fellows who are brimful of confidence and who plunge with grateful eagerness into any enterprise that offers a showy test of their abilities. I emptied the balls on the table and said, "Take a cue and a ball, George, and begin. How many caroms do you think you can make out of that layout?" He laughed a laugh of the gay and the carefree, as became his youth and inexperience, and said, "I can punch caroms out of that bunch a week without a break." I said, "Place the balls to suit yourself and begin." Confidence is a necessary thing in billiards, but overconfidence is bad. George went at his task with much too much lightsomeness of spirit and disrespect for the situation. On his first shot, he scored 3 caroms. On his second shot, he scored 4 caroms. On his third shot, he missed. Simpler caroms could be devised. He was very much astonished and said he would not have supposed that careful play could be needed with an acre of bunched balls in front of a person. He began again and played more carefully, but still with too much lightsomeness. He couldn't seem to learn to take the situation seriously. He made about a dozen caroms and broke down. He was irritated with himself now, and he thought he caught me laughing. He didn't. I did not laugh publicly at my client when this game was going on. I only do it inside, or save it for after the exhibition is over. But he thought he had caught me laughing, and it increased his irritation. Of course, I knew he thought I was laughing privately, for I was experienced. They all think that, and it has a good effect. It sharpens their annoyance and debilitates their play. He made another trial and failed. Once more, he was astonished. Once more, he was humiliated. And as for his anger, it rose to summer heat. He arranged the balls again, grouping them carefully, and said he would win this time or die. When a client reaches this condition, it is a good time to damage his nerve further, and this can always be done by saying some little mocking thing or other that has the outside appearance of a friendly remark. So I employed this art. I suggested that a debt might soften his nerves, and that I would offer one, but that as I did not want it to be an expense to him, but only a help, I would make it small. A cigar, if he were willing. A cigar that he would fail again. Not an expensive one, but a cheap native one of the crown jewel breed, such as is manufactured in Hartford from the clergy. It set him afire all over. I could see the blue flame issue from his eyes. He said, "Make it 100, and no Connecticut cabbage leaf product, but Havana, $25 the box." I took him up, but I said I was sorry to see him do this, because it did not seem to me right or fair for me to rob him under our own roof when he had been so kind to us. He said with energy and acrimony, "You still another point and finally reached 31. He stopped there and he took a breath. By this time, the balls were scattered all down the cushions, about a foot or two apart, and there wasn't a shot in sight anywhere that any man might hope to make. In a burst of anger and confessed defeat, he sent his ball flying around the table at random, and it crotched the wall that was packed against the cushion and sprang across to a ball against the bank on the opposite side and counted. His luck had set him free, and he didn't owe me anything. He used up all his spare time, but he carried his clothes to the carriage, and he dressed on his way to the station, greatly wondered at and admired by the ladies as he drove along. But he got his train. I am very fond of Mr. Dooley and shall await his coming with affectionate and pecuniary interest. P.S. Saturday. He has been here. Let us not talk about it. Martin.